This is Peace Talks, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. When the power of the nuclear bomb was unleashed by the United States at the end of World War II in 1945, a new challenge to the hope for world peace was unleashed with it. Even while the bombs were being created, and certainly afterwards, this central question has been debated. How can we prevent their use? Many have wondered, how can we eliminate them entirely, insisting that world peace can't be achieved without complete abolition of the weapons. To others, the existence of nuclear weapons has mostly meant security. They believe the deterrent power of these arsenals actually helps keep the peace. It also seems that many hearts and minds live somewhere between the need for some deterrent arsenal and the need to eliminate the world's nuclear stockpiles. Today on Peace Talks, Nuclear Disarmament.
I'm Carol Voss. Today on Peace Talks, we'll be talking with Dr. Zia Meehan, a research staff member and lecturer in the Woodrow Wilson School for Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. His research seeks to provide the technical basis for policy initiatives in nuclear arms control, disarmament, and nonproliferation, particularly in South Asia. With Dr. Meehan, we hope to understand more of the history of the development and proliferation of such weapons, learn about recent trends in both the spread of weapons technology and on the disarmament front, and work through some of the core issues in the debate. Dr. Meehan, welcome to Peace Talks.
Thank you.
Disarmament scholar David Krieger writes that the abolition of nuclear weapons is the most important issue of our time, and he says, "I do not say this lightly. I know how many other important life and death issues there are in our world. I say it because nuclear weapons have the capacity to end all human life on our planet and most other forms of life. This puts them in a class by themselves. Would you agree that abolition of nuclear weapons is the most important issue of our times?"
I'm not sure that I would prioritize it in terms of the most important. Certainly it is the case that the continued existence of nuclear weapons serves to distort the process of making choices about other pressing issues, like questions of how countries coexist. Any discussion and any progress on that question is distorted by the existence of many thousands of nuclear weapons in the world. It's hard to imagine a prospect of a path to a international community based upon peaceful coexistence when a few countries have thousands of nuclear weapons. It just blocks progress in that direction. Similarly, in the case of poverty, how can we talk about a path towards ending international poverty when, because of the existence of nuclear weapons, countries base their notions of national security on the preparations for war and the preparations for the capacity to use violence through technology at every available means to them? So countries with nuclear weapons have nuclear weapons. Others use whatever weapons they can get access to. And so necessarily there's a flow of resources in terms of money as well as human energies and intellect and emotion to those areas because they are privileged by the states away from questions of peace and coexistence and development. And so those to me are the really pressing issues. I see nuclear weapons as being a profound obstacle to the process of a collective human conversation about how we can answer those pressing issues.
In terms of the concept of nuclear deterrent, it assumes that a nation's possession of nuclear weapons is supposed to deter attacks by other nuclear nations and thus prevent war between the nuclear armed states. Now, this has been the argument for nuclear testing and nuclear armament, that it can help keep peace. You're from Pakistan and have written and spoken extensively of the nuclear crisis in that region. Perhaps using Pakistan and India as an example, let me ask you, does nuclear armament provide a nation with security? Is it a successful deterrent?
Oh, there's no evidence whatsoever from the case of the history of India and Pakistan that nuclear weapons offer any kind of so-called deterrent or any kind of stability or reduce the likelihood of war or even prevent a state from being defeated if war begins. And in India and Pakistan tested their nuclear weapons in May of 1998. A year later, Pakistan sent troops in disguise into the Indian part of Kashmir. And we had a war between two nuclear armed states. And both countries threatened to use nuclear weapons against each other. And yet they kept fighting. Their nuclear weapons were not enough to stop them going to war. They were not enough to stop them fighting the war. They were not enough to stop them from threatening to use nuclear weapons against each other. And the war was eventually resolved when the Prime Minister of Pakistan came to the United States and said, look, I've got myself into a situation I can't get out of. Help. And it was diplomacy that finally settled that, rather than either country having nuclear weapons or the United States weighing in with its nuclear weapons. And so I think, you know, that's an important lesson to learn. The second lesson that we've all learned since India and Pakistan had their nuclear tests is that the old argument that if they had nuclear weapons, they wouldn't need huge armies and conventional weapons, and therefore they could reduce military spending because war was going to be deterred. Military expenditure has gone up massively. In 1 year, India increased its military spending by more than the total military budget of Pakistan. And the next year, it did it again. So what did Pakistan do? It further pushed its people into poverty, further took money away from development, poured it into its military budget, tested more ballistic missiles. It's hard to point to any security benefit that has come to either country from having had nuclear weapons. But that was a lesson that was there to be learned from the history of the Cold War. That in 1949, when the U.S. nuclear monopoly was broken by the Soviet Union testing its nuclear weapons, we didn't see them say, okay, you have nuclear weapons, we have nuclear weapons, we know we can't fight nuclear war because we have a deterrent, so let's just stop this nonsense. No, they started building more and more and more nuclear weapons, which means they were not being deterred. They were preparing to fight. And they just thought that if we have enough nuclear weapons in a war, we can overwhelm the other side. And so we had this terrible scenario where the US and the Soviets built many tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. An even more important lesson that we've learned about, central to this question of deterrence that you ask, is that with the end of the Cold War, which was now almost 15 years ago, and the disappearance of the Soviet Union and the end of communism in the Soviet Union as an ideology that the US sought to confront, the weapons have not gone away. So what is being deterred when there is no enemy anymore? The weapons have become autonomous. They've taken on a life and a logic of their own, which goes beyond any possible threat of war between the United States and Russia. And so, you know, in a funny sort of way, the lessons that we can learn from the experience of the United States have been repeated in the experience of Pakistan and India, that nuclear weapons have only brought conflict, more military expenditure, and the prospect that even when countries are supposed to be at peace, they will keep their nuclear weapons anyway.
We're speaking to an audience that includes many people who work at the nation's defense labs. Some are completely certain that their work in weapons development is justified. Others may be conflicted. What would be your message to them as they think about their role in this?
The people who work on nuclear weapons and the soldiers who are responsible, if ordered to launch nuclear weapons, by and large think of themselves as part of a structure that is in defense of their country and their families and their communities. And it's an important question that I think that they should ask themselves is this a defense that they are comfortable with? Even if it is this a defense that they are comfortable with? Because for many of us, any defense that relies on mass murder and weapons of mass destruction is an unacceptable one. Let me tell you a story, if I can. There was a chapter in Mahatma Gandhi's autobiography where he tells about how when he was a boy growing up in India, and India was then a part of the British Empire, that many Indians couldn't understand why, you know, the British ruled India. And he said that Gandhi wrote that the kids that he was growing up with in school used to have a little nursery rhyme that they would sing. And the nursery rhyme went something along the lines of, "Behold the Englishman tall, he rules the Indian small because the Englishman eats meat. It's a funny sort of nursery rhyme, but you can understand it that in the context of a Hindu society where they are vegetarians and the British who ruled them ate meat, and the British were big and the Indians were small, just physically. For kids, it seemed to somehow suggest that there is some kind of magic that the British had and that the Indians didn't have that made it possible for the British to rule and the Indians to be the subjects. And so Gandhi writes in his autobiography how he and some of his friends decided that then if they were going to free India, they should go off and eat meat. And so he tells this really touching story of these little boys sitting on the bank of a river who've never eaten meat before, have no idea how to cook meat. And it was meat from a goat because that was all they could get their hands on. And it made them horribly sick. But then he writes that I knew I was trying to free India and defend my people. It was my duty to eat meat. And so he went back and kept doing it until eventually he just got sick of it and realized that this was a mistake and it wasn't going to actually solve the problem. And so that to me is a very insightful story. I mean, Gandhi wrote it in his autobiography as a parable to tell a story. And the moral of the story for me is that if you are feeling that you are in danger, if you are feeling oppressed, if you are in a situation where you are being dominated and overwhelmed and threatened, the way to resist is not to become that which you are afraid of. If they threaten you with nuclear weapons, then you become no better than them if you threaten them back with nuclear weapons. If you're going to resist and be better than those who oppress you, then find another way. And Gandhi found another way, which was enormously successful. It ended the greatest empire the world had seen up to that point without firing a shot. And so that's the challenge, I think, to people who think that nuclear weapons are a defense. It's not really a defense against anything, because you'll never move forward to actually being free.
Today on Peace Talks, we're talking with Dr. Zia Mian, a research staff member and lecturer at Princeton University. We're talking about nuclear disarmament and nonproliferation. I want to talk a little bit about international treaties, and allow me to give listeners a little bit of a background. In 1968, the U.S. and over 100 nations signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Many nations have met their obligation not to develop or acquire nuclear weapons, but the nuclear weapon states have failed to meet their obligation to eliminate their nuclear arsenal. And then in 1993, President Clinton ended U.S. nuclear testing. In 1996, he signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, a permanent worldwide ban on nuclear tests. The United States Senate has failed to ratify it. How effective are these treaties? What are the consequences of nations not abiding by treaties and their obligations for good faith negotiations?
Let me try and create a larger context for this discussion about international treaties and international security and nuclear weapons. When the United Nations was founded and the negotiations took place in San Francisco, just before World War II ended, the opening words of the Charter of the United Nations say that we, the nations of the world, committed to free humanity from the scourge of war, establish. That is the fundamental and defining goal of the United Nations, to free humanity from the scourge of war. The first resolution that was ever passed by the United Nations, Resolution 1.1, the first resolution ever passed, calls for the elimination from national arsenals of nuclear weapons. And it hasn't happened. And as you said quite rightly, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was a response by the United States and the Soviet Union to what they saw was the gradual loss of their privileged position as nuclear-armed superpowers. Now, the deal that was made that you've pointed out, was that the five countries that up to that point had successfully made nuclear weapons, the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, and China, promised that they would negotiate in good faith to give up their existing nuclear weapons if all the other countries in the world promised never to try to make them. What we have now is that all the countries in the world have signed this treaty except three. The three that have not signed are Israel, India, and Pakistan, and they all have nuclear weapons. But of all the countries that have signed, the five that originally had nuclear weapons 30 years ago still have nuclear weapons. As a matter of fact, they all have built more nuclear weapons after they signed the treaty than they had when they signed the treaty. All the countries that signed the treaty promising never to make nuclear weapons, almost all of them have kept their promise. Only North Korea seems to have succeeded in making nuclear weapons when it promised that it wouldn't. Iraq tried but failed. Iran, we believe, may be trying. But that means three examples out of 185 countries. Whereas five out of five of the nuclear weapon states have refused to keep their share of the bargain. The question that poses is, what then does international law and international treaties mean? And I think the answer is that it depends on the country. That when it was the case of Iraq trying to make nuclear weapons, the United States was willing to impose sanctions and willing to go to war to prevent this from happening. In the case of North Korea, the U.S. has been in negotiations with North Korea for more than 10 years to try and get them to give up nuclear weapons, including offering them bribes and threatening to go to war. In the case of Iran, the U.S. is again threatening Iran that if you do this, we will go to war against you. At the same time, the European countries are trying to make a deal with Iran to give them concessions so that they will not make nuclear weapons. And this is something that powerful countries can do to powerless countries. You can threaten them, you can offer them bribes, you can offer them some kind of bargain. But how do all the other countries deal with these five nuclear-armed weapon states? I mean, no one is going to be able to offer a bribe to the United States that will mean anything. No one is going to be able to threaten to impose sanctions in the United States that will mean anything. No one is going to be able to threaten to go to war against the United States in a way that will carry any convincing effect on U.S. policymakers. So the traditional forms of power that the nuclear-armed countries are able to bring to non-nuclear countries to make them keep their part of the bargain on the few who've tried not to are not tools that can be brought to bear on the powerful countries. So then, you know, what can we do? Since I'm committed to a democratic politics, what a country does is ultimately the responsibility of its citizens. It is for the citizens of the countries with nuclear weapons to turn to their leaders and say, we don't want to be defended by genocidal weapons.
Have there not been movements and people attempting to do this?
There are no examples of anti-nuclear movements who you can say have managed to get their countries to give up nuclear weapons in the way that you describe. What we have seen have been very instructive. And one is that there seems to be no difference between democracies and dictatorships when it comes to nuclear weapons. That the United States is a democracy, France is a democracy, Britain is a democracy. China is not. The Soviet Union was not. Pakistan is not. North Korea is not a democracy. And yet, in none of those countries are they willing to give up nuclear weapons. So somehow the notion that the democratic process by itself changes decision-making on nuclear weapons from that of a dictatorship, there's no evidence that's the case. What we have seen, though, is that where there are struggles for democracy, where democracy about how a country works and struggles over what power the government should have and what power people should have, where that becomes the central issue, there, countries have been willing to give up nuclear weapons. South Africa made nuclear weapons. But as the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela were more and more successful at challenging and bringing down apartheid, one of the first things that was done was that South Africa gave up its nuclear weapons. Brazil and Argentina both had nuclear weapons programs and ballistic missile programs at a very advanced stage. And yet, as part of the struggles for democracy in Brazil and Argentina, democratic activists, people who wanted more democracy in their society, said, look, we never asked for these weapons. Who decided that there should be nuclear weapons? Who is responsible for decision making on building missiles? We won't have them. And so that struggle for democracy ended up with both Brazil and Argentina giving up their nuclear weapons. And I think this has been, to me, an instructive set of examples.
Since the Manhattan Project was done in almost complete secrecy, would it be correct to say that there was very little public debate over whether the U.S. should develop these weapons?
No, there was no public debate. These things are almost always done in secret. No country has announced in advance that it's going to go off and build nuclear weapons, not even to its own people, and often not even to its own government. Congress was not told about the Manhattan Project. In Great Britain, which is has been a democracy for a very long time, most parts of the British government did not know that Britain had launched a nuclear weapons program. The second thing is, though, that even within those programs, there have been profound doubts among the scientists themselves about what they've been doing. During the Manhattan Project, when Germany surrendered, there were many scientists who said, we should stop the project now. The bomb hadn't been built. The decision makers in Washington, basically it was the president, since Congress didn't know about it, said, no, we're going to do it anyway. Right? And the scientists actually wrote a petition which they sent to the president asking them not to finish the project, but it went nowhere. The third thing, and that's perhaps the most important part that has been buried in history for a very long time, is that once nuclear weapons come into public scrutiny, in every country people are encouraged to think about them in terms of deterrence and national security. Whereas what you actually see underneath and behind the veil is a debate that is actually very moral, in couched in terms of right and wrong. And the clearest example of that is that in 1949, when the Soviet Union tested its nuclear weapons, the U.S. was thinking about, should it make a hydrogen bomb? And they asked some of the same scientists who had built the atomic bomb, led by Robert Oppenheimer, to set up a committee to ask the question, should the U.S. build a hydrogen bomb? Could it and should it? And they said, yes, we can build a hydrogen bomb, but we should not, because it is a weapon of genocide. And it's not common to find scientists using language like this, but the report that they wrote was declassified, and we know what they said, and they recommended that the U.S. not build nuclear weapons. I mean, this was the highest scientific advice that the U.S. government asked for and was given about building hydrogen bombs. Having asked for their opinion, having received their opinion, which was clearly a moral one, not a scientific one, the U.S. government went ahead and built hydrogen bombs and built them by the tens of thousands. And yet, the public were never told that this was the advice the government had been given about nuclear weapons, that this is what the scientists thought about it. Because if they had, they may have got a different public response. And so part of it, unfortunately, is that not only is the decision-making done in secret, but what's presented as the basis for the decision-making, that these are the terms within which debate can be had, are also picked by governments to take out many of the things that actually we now know were there. U.S. policymakers basically lied to the public to justify their use of nuclear weapons. When it was clear that the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was not widely welcomed by people, U.S. officials started to write articles and give lectures in which they said, oh, a million American soldiers would have died. And so we saved all those lives by destroying Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And now the historical documents that were actually there on the desk of the president and the desk of the generals have been declassified. We know what the estimates were of what the troop casualties would have been. And they don't come anywhere close to a million. They don't even come close to hundreds of thousands. And so they knew that that was what would happen if there was an invasion. And yet they lied afterwards to make it look as if we saved a greater loss of life by doing this. And it was deliberate deception.
So would you advocate then for broader education? Because you're talking about movements of people to make a change. And that's not exactly going to happen unless people are educated about what you were just talking about.
There was a survey done recently about American opinion on weapons of mass destruction by a group at the University of Maryland. And they surveyed people and asked them, how many nuclear weapons do you think the United States has? Now, the fact of the matter is the United States has more than 10,000 nuclear weapons, of which more than 2,000 are on alert and ready to be launched within 15 minutes of an order from the president. More than 2,000. The overwhelming number of Americans asked in this poll, how many weapons do you think we have, said 200. 200, as opposed to more than 10,000. Now, that shows the level of the gap between what government has and what people think their government has. The second part of it, they asked is, well, without telling them, they asked, how many nuclear weapons do you think we should have? And the overwhelming response was 100. And I think that tells you something that people may not know, but their heart is in the right place. They may think we have 200, but they think even 200 is 100 too many. And so once they start to appreciate the fact that we have 10,500 nuclear weapons, then we get to the question, well, how many do you think we should have?
I'm imagining listeners feel rather overwhelmed by this issue and think there's little they can do. What would you suggest to them?
Nuclear weapons are not an overwhelming issue. Not by any means. Falling in love is much more overwhelming. Right? Being a parent of a child is much more demanding as a human being than resisting nuclear weapons. Resisting nuclear weapons really comes down to relationships between people, because the technology is just a lump of metal that sits somewhere. It's a struggle between people and how they understand and relate to each other. And so the first thing to do, if you're actually wanting to be part of the struggle against nuclear weapons and violence in the world and for democracy, is to find other people who are like you. Because the old saying that trade unions and others made central was that in unity there is strength. The first thing is to realize you are not alone by finding people who share the values and the commitments to peace and democracy and nonviolence. Because only together can we start to understand how best to organize our effort, because those we are organizing against are already organized.
Okay, thank you so very much, Dr. Meehan.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
You can hear more from our interview with Princeton researcher Dr. Zia Meehan, as well as hear this program again at our website, peacetalksradio.com. You'll also find more resources on the debate over nuclear disarmament, all at peacetalksradio.com. That's where you can also hear all the programs in our series, as well as give us feedback and learn how to support the program. Peace Talks, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, is a production of Good Radio Shows Incorporated, a nonprofit media organization with information online at goodradioshows.org. Support for the program comes from radio station KUNM in Albuquerque and the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, making grants to enrich the cultural life, health, education, environment, and spiritual life of the citizens of New Mexico. Additional support from the Peace Tales CD Project online at peacetales.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Allie Adelman. I'm producer and engineer Paul Ingalls. For Carol Boss, thanks for listening.